Blog Talk Radio.
There is no earthly way of knowing.
Good man, a lot of time.
Which direction we are going?
La Recta El Camino. It would have been DWI.
Have reached a tipping point.
Welcome to Tipping Point. This is Stephen Platinum. I'm joined by Larry Goodman. I love the new intro. We didn't really talk about that last week, but somebody who helps out with the show and is a listener of the show sent that in. It kind of blends the Willy Wonka intro that we used to use, along with a number of like radio clips and sound bites from movies. It's really fantastic. Larry, Miss Rachel will not be here tonight, which I know is a disappointment to some people, but it's for a very good reason. She was there working the Fastlane pay-per-view. They ended up not using the Rosebuds, so she ended up not working, but they wanted her back for SmackDown, which is in Atlanta tonight.
Nice.
So that's why she could not join us, regretfully. So, Larry, let's go ahead and just open up with this. Our guests tonight are going to be Bill Barons and hopefully Davey Richards as well. Whenever Davey Richards calls in, we're going to cut right to him. But you went to the Ring of Honor show, the much-heralded Ring of Honor show. What a glowing report you gave. It sounded like it was just fantastic.
It really was. It really knocked me out. I've been to, as I said, a number of Ring of Honor shows. They've all been good, but this one really blew me away, and, of course, the Atlanta crowd blew me away. I figured, I don't know, I thought 500-600, but 1,200? Oh, man. And on fire all night long. Really fun to see, and I think it just lends more credence to what we've been talking about over the last several weeks about a resurgence of interest in wrestling in Georgia, because these folks were into it. And as I said, when I was cut in on Georgia Wrestling Now last night in their opening segment, was saying it seems to me these people were watching the TV. I mean, these were avid fans and who knew all the characters and were into everything. And it was really heartening to see that kind of response to Ring of Honor in Atlanta.
That is really heartening to hear about and to see. I want to contrast that with the Fastlane pay-per-view. I don't know if you saw it, but
no.
The story that I took away from that is it is amazing the difference that the crowd makes. I mean, it's an old cliche in wrestling that really the audience is another member of the troupe, if you will, going on. But boy, if that wasn't true, because there were a couple of things that I thought were really great in that Fastlane pay-per-view, but honestly, the crowd made the bad things worse and the good things not as great as they could have been just by not being as enthusiastic as they could have been. And
it was interesting because I did see Raw last night, and particularly the closing hour, and it sure looked to me like Daniel Bryan is cooled off. Mm-hmm. I mean, the yes chanting was not at the level I've seen it and heard it on other shows.
This is something that I was talking about with a couple of other people, and I might get sort of vilified for this. I'm going to say it anyway. I have always been of the mind that the yes chant phenomenon was 50% we love Daniel Bryan and 50% we're the same people who will still say what during a promo.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
And by the way, like Mike Moynihan put out a thing recently, which, I mean, you want to talk about something you would think anybody would be behind. I mean, the thing that nobody would disagree with would be God, isn't it time we just stop the what chant? Can we just let that thing die? It's been around for more than 10 years. It's horrible. And people, Larry, most people who commented on his thread on Facebook were pro what chant. Can you believe it?
In the sense of what, fans should have their voice and be able to, you know,
yes,
let it be known any way they wish.
Yes.
That's their right.
It was equated with people saying woo during the Ric Flair chops or the yes chant. And I just, it blew me away. I mean, obviously there are people who like doing it because it continues to exist. I mean, at PCW, I would literally stop the show. The first time I heard the hint of a what chant, I think I actually stopped everything going on and just cussed out whoever was doing it. And I went, not on this show. I'll close the doors before I'll let a what chant happen at a PCW show. And it was, you know, one of those things where I probably overreacted. I hate that thing like cancer. The what chant is so bad, I almost think it hurts Stone Cold's legacy.
Mm-hmm.
He's responsible for that monstrosity. But
well, and one thing, Steve, about the PCW shows, and particularly the Avondale, I mean, you had control of the room, and you could do as you wished.
Yeah, I was, you know, everything down from, I mean, I actually like slapped a fan before for trying to ruin my promo. That was old Harold J. Taylor. I actually slapped the glasses off of his face. And another fan who actually, like, hurt Mason. Mason got in this fan's face. He was the heel, you know, and got in the fan's face, and the fan kind of freaked out a little bit and poked Mason in the eye. And I grabbed the fan by the collar, dragged him over the rail, pulled him into the locker room. He probably thought he was going to get killed, you know, pulled him into the locker room and made him apologize. I mean, ridiculous. Again, can you tell that my dad is a lawyer? It's the only way you can explain actions like those. So the crowd was into everything at the Ring of Honor show. How you spoke on this just a little bit, but I was curious. What did you think of that place as a venue? You said it was different than where Ronnie Gossett ran his show, correct?
Yeah, I didn't care. Well, I mean, the main thing was the lack of elevated seating. Was crappy for the fans. Gossett ran a place with bleachers, or at least he had bleachers in there. It was a different room, and they had bleachers in there, so you didn't have the sightline problems. I mean, 1,000 people on the floor, that's not a good situation. When you're deep on the floor with no elevation. So, you know, people stand up at Ring of Honor anyway, but this just made it worse. Because there was no elevated seating for the people behind. So that was the only thing I didn't like about the area. I don't know why they didn't run the other space in there. I don't have any information on that. Plenty of parking. In that way, very good. Easy to get in and out of. That way, good. You know, so that's the negative.
I'm curious. You know, Ring of Honor is on their 13th. Anniversary, I believe that's correct. They've been running for 13 years, almost to the day. And how would you judge, I was having a discussion this morning with a couple of wrestling folks, how would you judge how Ring of Honor is doing? I mean, obviously Sinclair, they have to be, Ring of Honor has to be a little disappointed that the response from Sinclair in the last couple of months has been, you need to cut your budget a little bit. That they're not really going full bore into supporting Ring of Honor, like I think Ring of Honor and Kerry Sulkin and those guys would like. But judging from the Atlanta show, which is obviously just gangbusters, I mean, they hit a home run. There's really no way it could have gone better, right? Well, how would you assess Ring of Honor right now, 13 years later? Are they in a good position? Are they just riding a positive wave of pro wrestling in general? Or do you think that maybe they've turned the corner and can become a bigger, better deal?
I think they have momentum for what they're doing. One of the things I really like is, to me, they have a wider range of characters than they have in the past. You know, star power, okay, they still don't have great star power. And given their budget, that's really hard to do. But they do have a broader range of things they're doing. It's more of the circus with different things to appeal to different people than it has been in the past. I don't know that anybody has the platform. TNA, Ring of Honor, Lucha Underground has a sufficient platform to go to the next level, regardless of how good their product is. But I think in individual markets where they have TV, like Nashville and Atlanta, their popularity would certainly appear to be growing. They've done really well in Nashville, too.
You know, you got guys like, you got guys behind the scenes, like Gary Juster. And, of course, you know, I think the world of Gary Juster. And maybe it's just a case of their strategy is finally paying off. I don't think it's a secret that Gary Juster has been around this stuff a long time, and he started off as a promoter. So I think he makes the correlation between television and live gate stronger than anybody. So it's nice to see that, you know, it is really heartening to see that maybe Ring of Honor can follow their television markets into bigger and bigger houses. At least that's the hope. I don't think that that has worked by and large for the last 2 years, but like you said, Nashville and now Atlanta. And again, I think that uptick in wrestling continues. UIW with the ODB show drew in the like 240, 250 range. I talked to Jimmy Ox today.
Nice.
So, I mean, and for UIW as of late, that's a very good house.
Yeah.
You know, certainly I think ODB and, you know, with ODB and Pandora working up top, and it is really nice to see. You know, Peach State's obviously stabilized and come up in their crowd. I think Anarchy, they were in the 120s. We'll see if Charles can continue to sort of like beat the drum and get those houses higher and higher and higher as they build towards their end of March show, which is another big show for Anarchy. With Ring of Honor, though, it's just reading about all of the wrestlers that were there in the crowd was really funny. I just saw that great picture that they're calling the NWA Wildside Reunion, when they just had just a picture of a ton of guys. And it's really great. I think Ring of Honor is one of those few shows that really, it's almost like everybody can agree on liking that show.
Yeah.
It's one of the few where maybe not old school guys, but like you said, when I went to Ring of Honor in Lakeview here in Florida, one thing that just stunned me was that there is no longer, I mean, I used to think of Ring of Honor as the league where, I'll just be honest, the league where athletic white guys wrestled like Japanese guys. That's what mm-hmm. I used to call it. But now, I mean, it's across the board, and there's no more like, oh, well, it's Cedric and, you know, like a couple of black guys. I mean, it's a roster that is basically colorblind, and mm-hmm. everybody's kind of allowed to do their own thing. And like, I don't necessarily like all of the gimmicks that they're doing, but the fact is that there are gimmicks, that there are different takes on stuff, as opposed to, I'm thinking about the show that I went to, the Big Bang show, which was kind of the first under Jim Cornette's regime in April 2010 in Charlotte, where they drew very poorly for the size of that building. They probably had like 400 people there. And you know, they brought in all those Lucha guys in a hope of attracting a Hispanic audience, which didn't work at all. And the show was almost 5 hours long. And every match was 30 to 45 minutes long and felt very much the same beat. You didn't get that at all at the Ring of Honor show you went to, huh? That old, like, sort of Ring of Honor rep?
No, I didn't. I mean, they broke it up nicely. You know, they had, you know, a little comedy early, broke it up with ACH and Moose going to something completely different. And then even as good as O'Reilly and Strong was, and as good as Fish and Styles was, they were a little different. In they weren't giving you the same thing. And then they gave you the wild, insane brawl in the main event. So there was something. There were different things along the way. And then, you know, you had the crazy, you know, the six-way match with all sorts of stunt stuff going on. But, yeah, you didn't get that sameness feeling that I've gotten sometimes where, you know, I love it, you know, really athletic wrestling and flying wrestling, but a whole show of it with long matches, like you were saying, I mean, it gets dull. I mean, the sameness is deadening. And that was not a problem on this show whatsoever. And if I could say, you know, Kyle O'Reilly, I thought of him, a few years back as, you know, kind of a bland guy and, you know, a really good wrestler. But, boy, has he blossomed.
Yeah. I mean, the stuff he does in Pro Wrestling Guerrilla is phenomenal. I mean, Pro Wrestling Guerrilla always has that rep of being the kind of the out there show as far as what they do in the ring. They have guys doing, from just a move standpoint, doing moves that don't even look possible. There's that angle. Then there's the stuff where they kind of do like this meta wrestling stuff, which I don't know how I feel about it, but it's definitely compelling, and their crowd goes nuts for wrestling that comments on wrestling. They go nuts for it. And then you have guys like Kyle O'Reilly just laying it all out there, just laying it all. There's just no other way to say it. And it's so compelling. And, you know, I feel proud that Kyle O'Reilly, like, he didn't cut his teeth at PCW, but certainly whenever Davey would come in, he would bring Kyle with him. Mm-hmm. And Kyle would always be put in a match with a top guy at PCW and deliver the goods. It is great that it's all the little things. It's facial expressions. It's just telling that story with his body and going for it emotionally. It's so fun to watch. Like, that's another thing about Ring of Honor. I think if they can have a variety and their show becomes fun to watch, not just fun to watch for hardcore wrestling fans, they might be able to get that elusive thing that they've gone for since really the end of Gabe's run as Booker, which is they've always wanted to cross over in some way, shape, or form. They've always wanted to appeal to a bigger audience without alienating what I call the angry virgins, right? Like, that's always been their problem, is they don't want to alienate the 300 to 400 that will come as long as they're doing Ring of Honor style matches, that will always be there. But here's a question for you, Larry. So you had 1,200 people there, and how many women would you say were there?
I would put it this way. Not many, but maybe percentage-wise a little more than I've seen at other Ring of Honor shows I've been to.
Gotcha. I'm convinced that's key. You know, they got to – I mean, they're of course, Ring of Honor would be loath to sort of sell the sex appeal of the men, but there was a time where wrestling in the early days of the television era where half the audience were women. And I think wrestling is kind of like the bar business, kind of like the nightclub business. ECW showed this too. It's like you can get big appealing to sort of hardcore male wrestling fans, but you can only get so big. At some point, there has to be an appeal to women. I don't think you have to run a family-friendly show. I do think you have to run a show that encourages women to watch. And, you know, maybe Ring of Honor is beginning to stumble onto something if the numbers are going up for women.
You know, the thing I would say about that is what I saw was more couples at this show. Well, what I haven't seen, like I used to see at the Omni, was groups of women coming to see the men.
Yeah.
That still is not happening in Ring of Honor. So if they get that, they'll have something.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what would Bill Watts say, right? I mean, if Bill Watts would walk in and go, who are you blowjobs, right? Who are the guys that you can put in a match with, say, the Briscoes, where women are a little bit frightened for the guys going against the Briscoes and whatnot. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about star power and Ring of Honor, AJ Styles was on that card, and there's something I wanted to point out that I thought was really great, and it's probably a great segue for Bill Barron's being on here in just a moment, that AJ Styles was picked as a Wrestling Observer Wrestler of the Year. And something that's amazing about that, so he's been Pro Wrestling Illustrated number one, right? And now Observer Wrestler of the Year. I believe the only guy to pull that off who did not work for the WWE prominently. WCW back in the day. I mean, that's a really amazing accomplishment. And he did it without being in TNA. Like, this has been stuff that he's done on his own, basically Japan and Ring of Honor. And that's a major – I don't think people realize what a big deal that is when you don't have the WWE machine behind you. Many of your matches are not seen on national television. In fact, almost none of his have been in America lately. And yet he's Wrestling Observer number one, and he's been PWI number one.
Well, maybe. Steve, I think it's pretty timely that we're talking about AJ Styles when I believe we have our guest on the line right now.
Oh, well, multi-time winner, Booker of the Year in Georgia. He has worked for any company worth anything in the wrestling business. Very prestigious man joining us here on the show. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Bill Behrens. How are you tonight, Bill?
I'm fine, thank you. And I enjoyed the musical fanfare. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you. No, please sit down. Thank you, please. No, too much, please.
Larry, do you have a question for Bill to start us off?
Well, first, I haven't really gotten to congratulate you on the long-deserved and long-overdue award for the Mentorship Award in the Georgia Wrestling Awards for this year, so congratulations for that. And I wondered what your thoughts were on getting that award.
Honestly, I've always thought the awards were really cool, and when they were relatively created, one was named after me and with Paul Jones at the other end of it. And thereafter, any time I won an award, of which one is named by me, it was always sort of odd. I'm sort of a guy that's been recognized creating the awards that I'm winning. So I always wondered about that. But the one thing, and I told many people this over time, the mentor thing, which I thought was certainly apropos when Ted passed, and it was a great way to get it started because he was one of those kind of guys, and I worked with him for years, is I took a direction in wrestling that was different from many other people in wrestling. There are a variety of promoters, there are bookers, there's all these other things, and what I decided to do and realized I was best at was developing talent. I'm a terrible promoter, just literally a terrible promoter. I have to scramble to make a dollar, and it would drive me crazy to try to make a living that way, where the Burt Prentices of the world are brilliant in that area. But Burt couldn't book his way out of a paper bag. And in terms of building talent, he's very narrow-minded. He has a very narrow focus. And one of the things I like about the award, and I'm blessed to be involved in, is that I've been able to be involved in a diversity of people and hopefully help them either get better and get somewhere or realize they were only going to get so far and have a good time getting that far. And it's not that I can teach anybody to lock up, but I can teach people how to find whatever it is they have and recreate themselves. An example from Ring of Honor, Mike Posey, referee, been with everybody, went to two WrestleManias, came back, had to learn how to wrestle, and he's been recreating himself ever since because nobody pays attention to him as a referee, and now he's on a Ring of Honor show as P-Dog, a white black guy. Those are the things that allow me to have a good time every day and get up and do the rest of it. The rest of it's booking people and trying to make the money. But whenever somebody can go out and recreate something and have a good time, then you're actually doing something, because that's wrestling. Wrestling is an art form. And when people are allowed to be artists and get away with it, it's a nice thing.
Bill, you pointed out that Mike Posey was on the Ring of Honor show. And, Rachel is there tonight at SmackDown. And one thing I noted about the Ring of Honor show when I read Larry's report is the guys who are working on that show, the guys that are getting jobs as rosebuds on WWE, you know, the TNA roster, number of guys on the WWE roster are guys that have gone through Wildside and Anarchy. Even the PCW people who are on Ring of Honor and WWE Tonight basically went through Anarchy to get there. Is that something that gives to you? I mean, obviously you're proud of that. Is that something that has been a design from the beginning, that that's what you want to do, is you want to get guys to that next level through Anarchy?
Honestly, yes. I tried to be a promoter for a period of time, but I honestly learned what my skill was when I was working for Burt, because Burt would book the main event and really didn't care about the rest of the card. And when Stephen Dunn or somebody else was booking it, we had some good things going. But otherwise, Burt was just interested in the main event, and usually that was Colorado Kid. And I had learned before that by working with Dutch and others to book top to bottom and develop characters underneath. So I decided, I was looking at what Burt was doing. It was the same people doing the same thing after a while. We just weren't doing anything. So the Hardys reached out to me. I brought in Shannon Moore. We had been working with Shane Helms with Mike Maverick at one point, and we still liked him. And then the rest of those guys brought in Christian and Joey, and all of a sudden we were adding people, and other people were paying attention to the addition of those people, and they weren't the same people that had always been there. They were fresh blood, willing to try to do something. So what I wanted to do when I came into Wildside eventually, after failing, you know, I didn't fail. I did okay promoting, because I promoted a lot for a year and a half, but I didn't really make any money, but I didn't lose any money. It was just a lot of work. And then I realized that it'd be easier just, instead of booking the older guys, the guys that are still out there trying to get paid, it would be more fulfilling to try to find the people who want to get paid and actually have a chance to get paid in a real sense and actually accomplish something. Because no matter how talented the various people I work with who have a lot of experience, the veterans, they're really not going to get that last ride. And so you have to focus on the people that are going to get the first ride and the second ride and the guys that are going to potentially be the stars of the future. And so that was what I decided I needed to do, and that was what Wildside became after a transition of under a year where we had to get out of what they had been doing and me repositioning. So when you saw Air Paris and AJ and then all of a sudden the younger people coming in and Delirious and Matt Sydal, and you know, you can run through the generation, we changed from having the road hogs to developing talent. And that's sort of the direction I wanted to take on. And if I've done anything in the business, I hope that that's the one thing that I'm given some degree of credit for, is that I've tried to create new stars and not pay them, have them show up and beat themselves up for nothing, but hopefully get it to the point where somebody else wants to pay them.
Mm-hmm. Bill, when we went, you know, when Anarchy went through this recent period where Franklin Dove was needing to sell the company and move on, and it was unclear what was going to happen there. Did you yourself consider coming back, at least on a temporary basis, to run Anarchy?
The thing with Franklin, my position with everybody who owns what's called Anarchy is you are paying the bills and I'm in charge. And what I want to do is what's going on. And as long as that's okay, then I'm there. And if that isn't okay, then I'm moving away. The challenge with Franklin is that because of decisions he was making in his personal life and where he wanted to be based on where the other people in his life were, we knew eventually he was not going to be around, but it was just we never knew when. So everything was being booked for a period of time by Todd and I on, I swear, I felt like I was doing TNA where I'm booking to the next pay-per-view, you know, and therefore I'm doing a really terrible job. In fact, I think we deserve Booker of the Year for last year only because we had the most ridiculous scenario in that we could not focus on anything long-term with anybody. We couldn't develop anything. We had to deliver things immediately and pay them off, and we could only focus on one or two people long term, like a development of Billy Buck, something like that we could do over a long term. But you can't do that many things when you have to pay stuff off and you don't know if you're continuing, you know, because if we're building Billy and he never gets to pay it off, oh, well, we tried. You know, that's sort of, but you can't do that with everybody. You have to be able to pay things off to keep going. So that was the frustrating part of the time where Franklin was deciding what he wanted to do. And now, you know, fortunately, we got to a certain point. I think we did a good job, and we came up with some creative ways to throw a, you know, smokescreen over our lack of good booking. You know, the Fright Night multiple cage thing was my way of going, this can be done well, and it gives us a way out.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we were taking advantage of tricks, you know, and getting to this point where now I think we'll move forward, and I think people are going to be intrigued with what we go forward with, because we're actually going to be able to deliver something that's compelling and that's real and that has some emotion involved in it, and people can get behind and decide what they think is right or wrong, because they're, you know, my favorite kind of booking is into the gray as opposed to black and white.
Well, yeah, and in hindsight, it explains a lot of, as you said, about why the lack of the uncertainty about Franklin's situation explains a lot about the murkiness in the booking over the last year. One other question about that, though, would, if the ownership situation had gone differently, would that you may just not have continued on at Anarchy, is that right?
No, I'm not going to finance anything ever again. Bless my heart. I'm sorry, guys. I don't have the patience for that. That's I never lost money doing it, and I never want to try to not lose money again. It's a very difficult thing to do. If somebody else came in, and whether I was involved was always dependent on whether that person agreed to my ridiculous rules where they have no voice. And it's, you know, that's a tough spot. But Charles and I spoke, and I let him know, and I told him he can recommend people. I told him he can suggest things. But inevitably, I'll say yes or no, and that's the decision. And as long as that's fine with him, it's fine. You know, everything's going to work. When it's not fine with the guy that's paying the bills, then I'm obviously not going to be around. And that's been the stumbling block with Jerry, you know, back in the day, and we did some wonderful work, and then Jerry wanted to do things he wanted to do his way for a while, and I went somewhere else, and then I came back. So, you know, but it's a really tough spot. If I were the owner, I would never agree to work with me.
Bill, to change directions, you brought up TNA. I remember the podcast you used to do where you would analyze TNA's ratings and what it meant and kind of try to educate the audience on what ratings were, how they worked, how sometimes you didn't see the effects of things right away, sometimes you would, and that kind of thing. I miss those podcasts. I thought that they were really good and very different. Looking at, you have any number of clients who are still with TNA, what's the general vibe that either you have or that they have about their move to Destination America? Is it a positive thing, or is it more like, well, this is just a Band-Aid on a wound? What is the mood at TNA and your general feeling about TNA right now?
Well, TNA redefined their business fairly dramatically by taking a step backward in theory to take a step forward. Elements of that are simply a step backward. When you eliminate house shows, you affect a cash flow in one area and also in another area, because the primary merchandise sales for the company were driven by the house shows. So when you eliminate that and you eliminate the downside of booking something that doesn't draw versus the ability to make something at those shows, you're taking something out of the equation. What they decided to become was a television company focusing on a network that wanted a driver program to hopefully deliver within its limited universe. And I was skeptical going in, but quite honestly, if you watch the numbers, no matter what you think about the product or TNA, for them to come in and within the two broadcasts, because they have a mixed tier because the West Coast gets a feed after the East Coast, but they're drawing, you know, a 500,000 to 600,000, even a little bit more on any one weekend, even with the, you know, the duplicates. And they were drawing just under 1 million where they were with a much larger universe. Discover America is, for them, it's like the Holy Grail. They're, you know, they're dancing on air. They're so happy. And this is a wonderful thing. And they've also delivered for TNA, admittedly within their own universe. And I was skeptical that this would be advantageous for them just because of how badly the product is done on Spike. But now I'm beginning to think that it may be sort of, you know, the more you love, the better everything works out over time. They're at a network now that loves them, that would like them to succeed because it's an investment they've made to grow their universe. They're actually picking up TNA to grow their network as opposed to the network thinking that they can put TNA on as part of their already existent growth. And that's where Spike was. It's, yeah, TNA, it's another show. Yeah, it's okay. Destiny America, it's, oh, TNA. So they've got multiple shows, and that'll cross-promote. And it appears so far it's becoming fairly successful. You know, within their universe, 600,000 people on average, which is where they've been over the last few weeks, is really not a bad thing at all.
Bill, what is their Destiny America?
A million.
Yeah, I was.
Say it again.
How many homes are they in versus TNA? I mean, versus Spike.
I honestly don't know the exact number, but they're around half. Maybe
okay.
A hair more. It's a really limited universe right now because it's a growth network within the Discovery universe, so it only has limited carriage, and some of the carriage is really, really weird tiered. So, like anything else growing in the universe of satellite and cable, everything's vying for their space, and some of the people are able to charge for it, and others are desperate to get it. And Discover America is in the last part, which is they're desperate to get it, which means there's very little revenue that flows from them getting additional carriage except the ability to get households and therefore sell more advertising. So they're in the growth mode at this point, whereas people like Spike are trying to get more money by their availability to a cable provider. So it ends up being two different businesses. You know, I'm sure if you've had Dish or any other network in your home, you know that for a while Fox wasn't around on some networks because they were quibbling about how much money Dish had to pay. Then all of a sudden I'm a Dish customer and I get a notice that the Dish prices have gone up $5. Literally. So, I call Dish and tell them that I'm not paying it, and of course I'm still paying what I used to pay because I bitch. But still, that's the process. Discover America is not in that right now. They're a new tier, so they need sizzle to their steak. And right now, TNA is not doing a terrible job at that.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
We talked right before you got on, Bill. We were talking about AJ Styles, and I had commented that he won Wrestling Observer Wrestler of the Year. He's been number one in the PWI 500, and he's doing all of this without TNA. Where do you see AJ Styles' career going? Obviously he's hot ticket right now. People want him. Do you have any insight on what his designs are as far as his own career and what you think he's going to be able to pull off in the next couple of years?
It depends on how you qualify and quantify what is, the next big step. Because, within Allen's career and everything he's accomplished to date, for example, just two-time IWGP champion as a Ganjin is relatively remarkable. If you look at the other guys who had it, all were size of buildings,
Yes.
So he's the first work rate small guy that's been given credibility on a worldwide level on his own, which, we did. And he deserves all the credit for accomplishing it. But we had wonderful partners involved in that, people that actually believed in him, respected him, and made him feel welcomed in their locker room. Ring of Honor has treated him like the guy he is. I was backstage, and when it comes down to what's going on in a match with AJ, there really isn't anybody involved except AJ and what is going to happen in the match with his opponent. There's really no other involvement. This is the match for tonight. Go have a good time, and inevitably it becomes something very, very good, because we've paid an awful lot of attention to why he is a star and why he deserved to be a star, and he's learned how to deliver. You know, we've had some unfortunate things that have made him a star in a different way. I mean, people not knowing how to wrestle in some ways has created problems for him. You know, there's people that have decided that a face bump needs to be taken on the back of your neck, and I have yet to figure out exactly why that's a good idea, but at least some people thought it was and have gone to that. Interestingly, Kaz did that, and that's one of, you know, Alan's best friends, so even really great people make bad mistakes. But it is a bad mistake. And some people simply get scared being upside down, which is what happened with at least one Japanese guy. He'd never been upside down before. It confused him. And that didn't end up well for him, and he wore a halo for a while. So, so Alan's had some remarkable things happen, and then he's also had some controversy, and sometimes the combination of that is not a terrible thing. To be famous and infamous is not a bad thing. To be loved and hated is not a bad thing.
No, it certainly created a certain aura around him with the controversy about the clash and so forth, hasn't it?
Yes. And it wasn't created deliberately, but certainly
no.
It can't be denied, nor will it be. I mean, one of the great things about Alan is he's an honest person. So if somebody gets hurt, then it is what happened. And if he believed he caused that problem, he would fess up to it and claim personal responsibility. If he doesn't believe it and he thinks that people are, you know, whining about their own incompetence, then he's going to say that. And that's a position that gets attention. But it's the truth the whole way through. There's never a degree of dishonesty about what he does. Everything he does is real. And accordingly, I think that's why he's becoming a great star on his own. TNA tried to make him into something they needed as opposed to taking advantage sometimes of what he was. And what we're doing is what he is.
I have one more question, Bill, and this is a completely different direction again. When I'd once read Howard Brody's book, and there was a time like that picture that you put up where it was like you called it like the Wild Side, the NWA Wild Side reunion at the Ring of Honor show, where there were just so many guys there. It got me to thinking about the NWA, and you were vice president. You were a great representative.
I was actually a president, too. I was a president at one point.
Well, I was going to ask you to talk about that. What is your feeling now looking back about your time as a bigwig in the NWA, vice president and president? Are there things that you would have done differently? What do you think of the NWA currently? That kind of thing.
We were always flawed in what the NWA was from the beginning because all of the people involved had their flaws, strengths and weaknesses. You know, whenever you're dealing with a bunch of promoters, you're dealing with a combination of talented people and idiots. So we had a healthy mix of both, and that was from the very beginning. We had wonderful people that are easy to deal with than others, and Howard is a dreamer. He always has been. Howard is all blue sky. No matter how much he fails, he succeeded. That's Howard. You know, he's the guy that will continue to put his hand on the stove when it's hot. That's Howard. So, and my spot coming in, once I was in, was to constantly go, well, Howard, we need to calm down. And Bob Trobisch was one of those guys. And then we had all of these various owners, some of whom have gone on to infamy in their own way. I mean, one of our, without being specific, one of our former members, who actually may well have been a president at one point, ended up going to jail for major drug abuse and an underage girlfriend in Florida. So, you know, we always had a strong group of highly moral people involved in what we were doing. But that discounted the difficulty of dealing with the people involved in the company. Howard did do one thing, which is he maintained the ability to grow the brand, and we did accomplish something. We had reasonably good champions. Whether you think Mike Rapata is, Steve Corino wasn't bad. Sabu was good for the time he was in there. Danny Severin started. We transitioned to good people all the way through. and we had an involvement with Japan, and we grew things, and we actually had people paying attention, and we went from the magazines that actually existed at the time not paying attention to paying attention. Then we set up a relationship with TNA, and that enhanced the brand more, and more stars got involved, and the brand was getting better, and we were being paid by it. We weren't getting rich, but things were getting good. And that was continuing. I think the generation after TNA, when for good or bad reasons, we all divorced, and there's good arguments on both sides, but TNA was probably the smartest to get out because they needed to enhance their own brand to grow. But the key things is we kept doing more things and enhancing it. And you know, the Adam Pearce, Cort Cabana thing was I thought, awesome. We initially were going to put the belt on Bryan Danielson, but he got signed, and things kept changing. But we were in play with real people, and the brand was growing. And then again, we added members. And at one point, we added members who came in differently than I thought they did, and the end result was a lawsuit, and the end result was a change in the ownership of the brand, and now I'm not involved at all, couldn't give a fuck.
Well,
but I mean that in only the nicest sense of I couldn't.
So one more question, Bill, before we let you go. How has your life changed since AJ Styles became a free agent and embarked on this world tour, et cetera, et cetera?
More fun, because I had little to no input on what TNA was doing. We were just dealing with it. And, they, you know, in the last 4 or 5 months of trying to negotiate a return that was just, you know, mind-numbing in so many ways, you know, so it was, you know, the end of TNA was not good at all, and was providing nothing financially that was advantageous for anyone. We were just sort of treading water. And now we're creating something new. So anytime you create something new, that's a pretty cool thing. And, you know, the older you get and you can create something new, that's nice. You know, by the way, you mentioned Miss Rachel is backstage. I would also point out that so is Slim J, so is Jeremy Foster, and so is Lars Manderson. So there are a diversity of nice anarchy-related people, platinum-related people that are enjoying the excitement that is WWE over the last few days.
Thank you. And Bill, go ahead, Steve.
I was going to say, Bill, I can't thank you enough for being on. It's always a pleasure having you on. I'm going to definitely do my best to come by and see an anarchy show soon. And you know, anytime you want to be on, just let us know, because you're always a fantastic guest. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh, and by the way, say hi to Davey and tell him I literally never knew he had worked my Friday show that he broke his leg on. I swear I never knew that. I only found it out later in life. I only remember his really not-so-good match at Anarchy, which, you know, you can share with him, Larry, if you want to spend, if you want to really. And I guess we're done.
Yeah. Sorry, Bill. I hit the button too soon.
That's okay. I just heard beeps. I had no idea what was happening. I thought maybe something was attacking.
No,
aliens.
That's it.
It's aliens.
Well, is Davey ready to go on?
I believe Davey's on right now.
Great. Hey,
go to Davey.
Davey,
say hi to Davey. Thank you very much.
Bill Barron says, hello, Davey. How are you tonight?
Hello?
Hello?
Hey, guys.
Hello?
Hey, how are you?
Do you guys hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Okay.
So, Davey, let's go ahead and just jump right into it. Tell us what happened on the plane ride over from England. I read a little something about it. So what went down? TNA was in England, obviously an incredibly successful tour there. And then on the way back, on the plane ride back, something happened. Can you walk us through that story, please?
In England. On the way back, I was. Training a medical person because of an emergency. I'm a flight paramedic. So I went there and I showed her my license, and she had she had a normally slow heart rate. So I started an IV on a little meg, and I gave her some medicine. I mean, it was safe there, and they kind of, then TNA ran a story on.
I'm afraid we have a terrible connection here. Can you hear us, Davey? We can.
Yeah,
you're,
I can hear you.
Cutting in and out.
Green?
Very little. We could only make out a word here and there. I'm sorry. We could not make out what you were saying about the story on the plane.
Not now.
Maybe, Dave, if you can hear me, maybe you should
Dropped off. He dropped off, Steve.
Okay. Well, why don't
we
a holiday memory from Mr. T that we'll play, and then we'll see if we can bring Davey back on. How's
okay,
that?
We'll do.
Arbor Day, Bastille Day, Boxing Day, Remembrance Day, Canadian Thanksgiving.
It is now time for Holiday Memories with Mr. T.
What up, fool? This is Mr. T's time to talk about his favorite holiday memories. President's Day is when America honors all its great leaders of the past. What the greatest leader in the history of the World Wrestling Federation was my mother. My mother was president for many years, and she ruled justly and fairly, and she never put her hands on a wrestling man. My mother always made sure the title was defended within 30 days. And my mother stood strong, stood tall, with her suits sharp, with her jaw cut of granite. But my mother was pushed too far one day in 1991. She was trying to have a conversation with Brother Love. Bad News Brown shows up saying that she had had lewd and lascivious contact with Miss Elizabeth. This was taking it too far for my mother. My mother looked at Bad News Brown in his eye and said, "You may look like TC, but that does not make you awesome. Comb your beard." And she pushed him right in his chest. And that is why my mother was the greatest president that ever walked in the World Wrestling Federation.
Wow.
You may look like TC, but that doesn't make you awesome. Who would make that kind of a comment? A little inside there from somebody, from that Mr. T, whoever that Mr. T is.
It's always a mystery. Who is Mr. T has now almost surpassed who is Eric Embry in the emails that we get. So,
cool.
Is Davey back on?
He has not reappeared. No, Steve, he has not.
Yeah, obviously he had a rough connection. Though a minor miracle has occurred that Bill Barons and Davey Richards did both call in. So clean it up. Before we talk about something else, I want to talk about next week's show. So, Larry, you landed us a guest for next week's show. Can you tell us about him a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, I couldn't help but notice that Sal Rinaro made his return to the ring at Peach State Saturday night, his first Peach State match in 4 years, I believe his first match in probably three since Rampage closed down. I'm sure he'll fill us in on that. But our guest next week will be the one and only Sal Rinaro. And, you know, we'd really like to touch on all aspects of pro wrestling on this show, and we're going to talk a little merch next week, because he'll be joined at least in part by his partner on TNA merch, Tony Locascio, a fine independent manager, a great talker. We may have a real hard time getting a word in edgewise next week, so it should be interesting.
And of course, Miss Rachel will be back with us again next week. Sal Rinaro, Tony, great guests. Larry, I have a question for you in regards to it was a question I was going to pose to Davey, but I'll sort of reword it and pose it to you instead. So, you know, there's an article that I'm writing, and it's sort of tracing. It starts with talking about Dynamite Kid, and how Benoit was sort of cut from the Dynamite Kid mold. You know, clearly, right? Idolized the Dynamite Kid. And both of their lives in wrestling kind of went this tragic route. Obviously, Dynamite Kid, bound to a wheelchair, kind of very, you know, just beaten down physically, his style of wrestling leading to all of this. And then, of course, Chris Benoit, it's wrestling's most tragic story. And Davey Richards, to me, was in that mold, but then broke out of that mold and would kind of catch a lot of hell for, you know, openly saying he wanted to retire, kind of always implying that he had a life outside of the wrestling business, which, you know, that's the biggest sin in wrestling, right? Is you have to devote your entire life to it, you know, even though that's proved that that's how incredibly bad that is for you. But Davey's kind of forged his own way, you know, got his EMT license, got this kind of medical license, has sort of given himself a landing pad outside of wrestling, turned down WWE in favor of TNA, mostly because of it's just an easier lifestyle and an easier schedule. Larry, do you think that wrestling is changing in the sense that are guys going to be more like Davey and less like Dynamite and Benoit? Like when you look at the new crop of Ring of Honor guys or the guys on the indie scene, are things moving that way where wrestling is just seen as a part of their life and not their entire lives? And if so, is that a good thing or a bad thing? It's a big question.
I think the answer is yes, there will be more guys in that direction because they came up differently without the territories. They didn't break in working 5 and 6 nights a week where it was their total life and they were traveling on the road with the same crew of guys, blah, 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 blah. That's not the life. That's not the way they broke in. So I think by virtue of that, they have a different mindset towards it. Is that better for better or worse? I don't really have a perspective on that. I don't think.
I kind of compare it to the difference between boxing and UFC, where boxing, I think you would get a certain kind of guy, and for most of them, boxing was an escape from a life they didn't want to live. And you kind of, you know, in order to be the guy that sort of emerged from sort of being poor, et cetera, you boxed your way out. And with that, I think you had a certain kind of guy, right? For good or for bad, it's you know, the sort of same story again and again. Guys that stayed in boxing too long, guys that couldn't give it up, guys that lived these kind of hedonistic lifestyles. Like you think of the wrestlers of the past and the kind of, like, you think of a Ric Flair and that sort of like jet set, you know, you make 5,000, you spend 10, you know, like all of that stuff. And now there's wrestlers who, I mean, I hear complaints, like older guys at the WWE complaining. It's like, oh, a lot of these new guys, all they want to do is they want to bring a video game system and set it up in the arena. Like, it's definitely a different time, you know. The age of, I think the late 90s are going to be the last time where the kind of hedonistic wrestling lifestyle, you know, you think of WCW and ECW, where it was just sort of like these drug havens, let's be honest, right?
Yeah,
drug havens. And, you know, the guys were doing those drugs to get through to the next show. Not to always excuse everything that way, but that's a fact. You know, they were hurting. They were doing roids as much as to recover from injury as they were to look big, honestly. And now the whole mentality has shifted. And even in UFC, there's guys who are, they're college-educated guys. Not all of them, but there's definitely a different level. I'm not saying they're less committed, but it's definite. You don't get the idea that Forrest Griffin is fighting because he's got some kind of inner rage from his childhood. You're not getting the feeling that, you know, like even an Anderson Silva, you never get the feeling that that guy is this sort of like hungry animal. And I don't know, is that going to be good or is that going to be bad? I'm not sure. I lament, I don't know if you do, Larry, I sort of lament the fact that the guys that I know, the guys that I've trained, there really is no way to work 5, 6, 7 times a week.
No.
And
no.
I may have been part of the last generation that got to do that. And not that I was ever big time, but there was a time where if you had enough hustle in your game and you were a little bit lucky, you could line up gigs for at least 4 days a week, if not more. And the guys that really wanted it went and did it. I don't know. Who are those? What is that going to mean for the long term if being trained means you go through NXT? It's going to be NXT or bust to be big time. I'm not sure what that is. What happens when the first – because Daniel Bryan, you look at the guys that they have who are going to be the next generation, right? The Seth Rollins, the Daniel Bryans, like the guys that went through Ring of Honor, a lot of those guys have been wrestling at least 3 times a week, but the next generation coming up, they're going to be guys that wrestle once a week, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
Or twice a week, maybe. Are they going to be able to handle working? I think people, you know, when they say, oh, yeah, because WWE, you work 300, you're on the road 300 days a year. I think that that's actually already an exaggeration, is it not? I mean, they wrestle, what,
it is an exaggeration. Yeah, yeah.
4 times a week. And, I mean, so, I don't know.
And you'll have that factor as going forward, you know, all the more of UFC siphoning off a lot of the really great athletic talents that would have chosen pro wrestling in past times. I certainly think it's going to mean that we're not going to have the wrestling tragedies that we had of the last generation and not the sad kind of hangers-on that we've wound, you know, ended up with some guys from that generation. I don't think that's going to, you know, carry forward. Because I think from the different mindset, you're not going to have near as much of that. I think guys are going to get out.
I'm gonna go ahead and say this, and it's not going to be very popular. So I'll just call it the pussification of America that's happened, especially with the American male. Like when I look at wrestlers on the indie level, mostly, who just put out in public and social media is, of course, part and parcel of all this. Who constantly throw themselves out there emotionally for the public. Not only does it render them, I know the thing that bothers you about it is it renders them very ordinary. It makes them very ordinary in the eyes of people who are supposed to want to pay to see them wrestle, right?
Yeah.
That's one of your big beefs.
Now they're just another guy on Facebook. Go ahead.
Yeah. Is sort of an indication of, is it a generation gone soft, just not as, I mean, good at appearing tough, but guys that, I don't know, it sounds crazy for me to say that, but are guys nowadays just not as strong? Is that the price paid for them not being Neanderthalic in behavior? Like, you know, you don't have there's no Johnny Valentines running around anymore, right?
No.
Guys who are like, you know, putting lighter fluid in guys' asthma puffers, right? Or guys that have a complete, like, detachment to other people as human beings because they're on the road so much that the only way they can entertain themselves is basically at the debasement of others because they're in this sort of carny business. Like,
yeah.
So you're not getting that kind of guy, but instead you're getting the kind of guy who is soft in a business that has never encouraged that before, but now seems to be almost accommodating that.
I don't think we're going to get any more like Joe LeDuc type people in, in probably in pro wrestling anymore. I mean, it's just not, we're not going to get those kind of characters. But that, I like that pussification of America phrase.
here's what's interesting, though. Like, I looked at, when I went to the TNA tapings, and I know we're running out of time, but when I went to those TNA tapings, one thing that I did think was wonderful was I think wrestling has transitioned from the days where you couldn't get the guys to, you know where losing a match was akin to throwing your career in the toilet in many guys' eyes, right? So, guy, it was hard to negotiate a proper finish sometimes. I think that's gone the way of the past for the most part. Though I do find it interesting that supposedly Brock Lesnar was difficult to deal with on Raw, and that's why they didn't put him on. Did you hear
mm-hmm.
about that?
No, I did not.
Brock Lesnar was apparently supposed to appear at Raw. Like, he was ready to go, and they were advertising him up until 7:30. But then once 7:30 hit, they pulled all advertisements of Brock Lesnar is going to appear tonight. And supposedly there was some kind of dissension. There's all this rampant rumor on what that dissension was. But to me, I look at Brock and I go, I think he might be the last of that kind of Bruiser Brody-esque guy who's
mm-hmm.
just like, you know what? You don't fucking tell me what to do. Like, you know, it's like, I do this for money. You know, I don't think that he would be above doing a job, certainly. I don't, especially for, you know, as long as the check clears, right? But at the same time, I don't think guys feel empowered or even have the ability to speak out unless it's, you know, I think the rare exception is like a CM Punk who just goes, you know, I've given myself enough of a landing pad. I'm just not going to take anybody's shit for a while and can walk away.
This is a tangent in a discussion for another day, but it just reminds me of the whole independent contractor thing and what a sham that is, and eventually WWE is going to be nailed on that. But just when you brought up Punk, it just reminded me of that whole aspect.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be an interesting year because what's weird is what we see in Georgia indie wrestling is things are looking up, or things are up, and there's a number of promotions running who are doing better houses than they've done in some cases in years, in some cases ever. There's kind of this new feeling of excitement, which I'm sure Charles would like to take full credit for, but let's be honest. I mean, even if Southern Fried was never on the scene and Charles never got involved, I think all of this would be happening, right? So, but yet the WWE feels like such an – the story used to be we need the WWE to do well in order for everybody else to do well.
Right.
Right? When the WWE does well, it's good for wrestling. But, I mean, isn't that not exactly the opposite? But the WWE, I mean, they didn't lose $45 million. They lost $30 million, and they celebrate. That, I mean, by any definition of any word, that's not doing well, right? But yet, maybe indie wrestling doesn't need the WWE as much as people thought that they did.
At least in Georgia, it feels like the tail is wagging the dog right now a little bit.
And Ring of Honor is set to a little bit. When is Ring of Honor set to return? You mentioned it in
August,
your report.
Last Saturday in August. 29th, I believe.
And by all accounts, that show should do gangbusters, should it not? I mean, based
absolutely.
On what you saw.
Absolutely.
Same venue,
yeah, and
all of that, right?
Yeah, and I think 6 months is the right time interval for them. I think that's a good time interval. But, you know, we've Eric Embry is chomping at the bit here to get on the air.
Well, then let's bring him on. And so next week, we got Sal and Tony on, everybody, for Larry Goodman. I'm Stephen Platinum. And now, Eric Embry, have a good night from Tipping Point.
It's Exotic Eric's Movie Review of the Week. All right, welcome to Exotic Eric's Movie Review of the Week. This is that old Eric Embry, pro wrestler and cinemaphile. Thank y'all for having me on. Now, this week, we're going to take a look at 50 Shades of Grey. Now, I hang out with this old Mexican lady named Esmeralda, and she's been telling me forever that I need to read this book. I tried reading her copy of it, but it's in Spanish, so all I understood was when they went to the beach of the library. Okay, flash forward, and Esmeralda says they made a movie out of it, and she says there's a ton of sex, and that's my kind of movie, so off we go. Now, I can tell something is wrong right away. First of all, the picture's real clear. No soft focus, no stock footage of Miami, nothing. Second of all, the people's names in the credits aren't plays on words like Penny T. Ration and Clint Torres, okay? Instead, it's just a bunch of old boring Jewish names. Lastly, there's a bunch of jabronis in the theater, and I'm thinking, uh-oh, this may not be a porno after all. Okay, so this one old gal has an interview set up with this rich dude. Now, she can't go, so she hot tags in her friend, the daughter of George the Animal Steele, Anastasia Steele. Now, she rides the elevator up, and the music in that old elevator is saying, money, 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 money. Now, okay, now, she gets up there, and this old Christian Grey, he's got that $1 million belt, and he's giving her the I'm gonna do you eyes. But she's all like, no, I can't, because I'm plain. And you know she's plain, because she's got her hair in a ponytail. Now, Christian, he's always training and running through the streets when it's raining with his hoodie on like Little Mac and Mike Tyson's Punch Out. And I'm thinking he's going to give this old gal a TKO from Tokyo. Now, Anastasia, she got more jobs than a Jamaican. Now, she's in school. She's doing this reporter thing. Later on, she's at a photo shoot. But old Christian, he catches up with her at her other job, the hardware store. Now, he says, hey, listen. I got a piece of hardware for you. Okay, he don't say that. But it would have been good if he did and then banged her right there on the Black & Decker display. But instead, we're still waiting for some sex to happen. So they hit it off, and she calls him drunk one night. And I'm like, uh-oh, here we go. But you know what? Instead, they get in this conversation about signing contracts, and that goes on and on and on. And I'm thinking, man, contract signing may be making the accountants in the audience hot and bothered, but Exotic Eric, is when he's hungry, you know, brother, he likes to eat at the In-N-Out Burger, okay, if you know what I mean. I think you do. Now, finally, we get down to it, and Christian Grey says, kayfabe, brother, I can't have sex the normal way. I need gimmicks. I need my Indian strap match. I need the Russian chain. I need the coal miner's glove. And Anastasia says, well, maybe. Now, most guys would have banged this old rat and then sent her packing with a signed 8x10 from the gimmick table, talking about see you next time I'm in Dothan, but not old Christian. He takes her up in a plane ride, and he says, hey, let me turn on this old radio, and you know what's on? Money, money, money. Man, we got it. You're rich, okay? Now, finally, they get it on, okay? It's good. I seem better, but it's good. In the blow-off, he commences to whipping on her like Jerry Lawler on Andy Kaufman. Man, talking about, you recognize this, Jerry Lawler? It's a bar of soap. Overall, man, I liked it. It shows the struggles that rich, good-looking, sophisticated guys like us go through when we're trying to get some strange. Plus, that old theater was cram-packed with middle-aged women that were ready to work that old gimmick stick like a claw game at the bowling alley. So, hey, man, it all worked out for me. I give this movie 3 shots from a Singapore cane, but kayfabe, brother, lovingly given. This is our old Eric Embry with a movie review of the week. I'm available for bookings and also behind the movie Cinemaplex. You keep the dirty side down, brother.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast. A production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network.
More jobs than at your baby.
Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.
There is a lot of delayed sexual gratification in that movie. I saw it over the weekend. He ain't lying. Wow.